You want kicking things out of orbit?
Oh my gosh!
I'm gonna just knock it sideways.
One of the greatest fighters.
John Jones beat every champion. Pretty much now.
Khabib gets his hands on McGregor, it's gonna be that night.
Let's get into it.
Hello! You are listening to the Fight Night Picks Recap Show. I'm John Franklin. This week on the show, we discuss all the fights from the UFC 260, Miocic versus Ngannou 2. I will do all this with one half of the Fight Night Picks Preview Show. I'm speaking, of course, with the great Matt Allen. Matt, how are you?
I'm great. That was a wicked card last night. I'm really happy to break it down the next day because we have a lot to talk about.
I agree. It was pretty wicked. All right, Matt. Saturday night, we were back in the Apex. Not a loaded card for the casuals, but a lot on this card that may shape up for the future. So storyline-wise, we have perhaps the biggest rematch in the history of the UFC. The former 170-pound champion looking to get back on track. Sean O'Malley's comeback fight. And a big test in the women's flyweight division. So listen, you dive deep into these fights, and you're really more about the matchups and the storylines, I believe. But talk to me about your thoughts going into this one, and let's set the table for what we're ultimately going to solve tonight. What did you like going into this card? What did you like about it?
I mean, of course, I'm not in the minority. I love the main event. I was super excited for the rematch. And whenever you have a guy like Francis who... I always think of Bismack Biyombo when I think of Francis Ngannou, because you just look at him and you're like, athleticism wise, he's a 10 out of 10. It's just the skills were really there, but you knew that he could get better since their first fight. Whereas Stipe, he was kind of a finished product. The finished product happened to be the greatest fighter of all time. So in my head, I didn't think that Miocic was going to improve that much. And I think in the end, we saw he didn't really improve that much, but Francis did improve leaps and bounds. That was massive. And for Tyron Woodley, I don't think it got spoken enough about the fact that that was the last fight on his UFC deal. I didn't even know that till fight week. Like, that was news to me until like Wednesday before he fought that, oh, Tyron Woodley might end his UFC career on a 4-fight losing streak. And just, it kind of sucks to see where he's come since he was the champ. I know Craig's one of the bigger Tyron Woodley fans in the world. Not a lot of them out there anymore, but just kind of wild to see how far he's fallen. But going into the card, I was pretty bummed out just because, listen, we had that great co-main event, Alexander Volkanovski, Brian Ortega. Everyone in the world was excited for it. And of course, it gets taken off because Volkanovski tests positive to COVID. But I still think at the end, we got a really good night of fight Saturday.
All right, let's move on to the main event, or let's get started with the main event. We'll start at the top with the big boys. It has been a long time since Stipe Miocic last fought Francis Ngannou. 3 years and nearly 3 months. However, Ngannou is the last non-Daniel Cormier opponent for Miocic. Last time out between these two, the fight was grappling heavy as Miocic went for 14 takedowns and landed 6 of them. Miocic won a unanimous decision in the fight. Had such a bizarro effect on Francis Ngannou that he had a performance against Derek Lewis that had many pundits saying he might be ruined and it might be the end for him. But he recovered, fought his way back to the title, and last night won it. The result reads Francis Ngannou, number one, defeated Stipe Miocic, champion via KO, 52 seconds of round number two. Matt, it looked like Stipe wanted to wrestle early, but Ngannou was having none of it. And once Ngannou earned that respect, Miocic just looked to be a sitting duck for the bomb that would ultimately blow up his title reign. That's what I saw. I saw when he stuffed the takedown late and then went to the back. He just looked like a different guy. Again, that's what I saw. What'd you see?
I really agree 100%. It was kind of weird, though, because Stipe didn't look like he had a plan for what to do when the fight was being contested on the feet. And yes, I understand you can't really stand in the pocket against some guy like Francis Ngannou because we all know how hard he hits. But Stipe didn't really land any strikes at range. And I know he landed like 15, 16 strikes, whatever the official numbers were after the fight. But it's not like he was landing clean and distance. He wasn't throwing out the jab. He wasn't really trying to set anything up. So for me, I don't really know what his game plan was after he couldn't get that first takedown. And I heard Chael Sonnen go on ESPN and say, oh, well, the only thing Stipe did wrong in that fight was he went up and to the left and not down and to the right on that takedown attempt. That might be the truth. It's just every moment that Stipe was on his feet, he just didn't look that comfortable in there. And I'm more excited for Francis winning than anybody. And I think he really did show that, like, this is our guy. He's going to be champ for a really long time. It's really hard to beat Francis. But I don't think that was the best version of Stipe that we've ever seen in the UFC cage. And I don't think that's very much of a hot take. Like, he didn't really move forward at all. He landed one good shot, but that was after he was already rocked. And he really only landed that shot because Francis was getting a little wild going for the finish. So for Stipe, I think Francis had a beautiful performance, don't get me wrong. And the thing I like the most about Francis' performance is that he didn't just go in there and knock him out with the first flurry that he threw. Like, he did defend the takedown. He did eat a big shot himself. He did have to stand at range, and it wasn't just one of those classic 30-second knockouts. And I think we learn a lot more about a guy when he does go in there, and he does have to show new wrinkles to his game that honestly none of us even knew that he had. Like, no one thought that Francis would go out there, have perfect wrestling defense, sprawl, do everything right, then take the back of Stipe, then take Stipe down. Like, it was just a really nice performance by Francis, because he was able to show more than just being that big, strong guy, and I think that was important. But I think it is true that Stipe did not have his best night by any means. I'm not saying he's going to beat Francis if they do have a third fight. I'm not saying there's a version of Stipe out there that could beat Francis who fought him on, or on last night, I guess, but I just think there was something off about Miocic in the end.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think that has gotten kind of lost in everything is really Francis's commitment to his craft. I mean, you know, they're fun things for social media, but when you see him like hanging out with Ryan Garcia, or you see him like doing some work with Teddy Atlas or doing some work with Mike Tyson, it just shows you that a couple of things. One, he's picking up little things here and there, and it just shows a commitment to just the overall fight game. Like, he's so entrenched in the fight game that he keeps finding himself around all these guys, right? He's in a lot of gyms. He's a, you know, he's a really big part of the community of Extreme Couture. He's not just flying in and, you know, I mean, he's like playing with Roy Nelson's kid. And I mean, he's just like a part of the fabric of that gym. I bring up Mike Tyson, or I will. I'm wearing a Mike Tyson shirt because one of the early knocks on Stipe Miocic, and we'll bring our boy Teddy Atlas back into the conversation, in saying that, you know, Teddy Atlas, when they asked about Mike Tyson, they said, you know, what's Tyson's record? And they said, you know, it's 50-3 or 50-4, whatever it was when they asked Atlas. And he said, I would go so far as to say he's 0-4, because anytime he's ever faced any adversity, he's folded. You know, that was kind of the Mike Tyson, Deontay Wilder, Francis Ngannou playbook, which was, They got the big strike. They'll overwhelm you. But if you can withstand the storm, you can win. I don't think that's the Francis Ngannou that we have anymore. I think he's a guy that can deal with some adversity. I think he's a guy that not everything has to go perfectly. He has a lot of different facets to his game. So did he have to go through that the trials and the tribulations of losing to Miocic, the weird Lewis fight, and all that, to kind of get to be where a guy where when he wins the belt, maybe he's prepared to go on a long run now?
I really do think he did make him ready. And I think the Lewis fight was as important as the Stipe fight, because if he did go out there again and just knock out Derek Lewis in the first second, you're not going to learn anything extra. I do think you need an MMA 5, 6, 7 losses before you really figure out what holes you have in your game. And I know that's not the sexiest thing to say, because I know a lot of people, they want your champs to be undefeated, but that's the great thing about MMA. People don't really get losses held against them. And yeah, there's people who like to make memes out of you after you've gotten knocked out. But for the most part, MMA it understands at this point, at least, that you either win or you learn. And for Francis, I do think both those losses were big, big learning opportunities. And I think for Francis too, again, I can't overstate just how important that first takedown stuff for Francis was. I will kind of liken that to the first time Connor hit Dustin in their rematch and he didn't fall down. Like, that's just such a confidence booster moving forward, because, you know, if Stipe's going to have any success with the takedown, it's either going to be A, in the like fourth or fifth round when both guys are exhausted, or it'll be really quick when Stipe has as much kind of explosiveness to his shots as possible. And Francis was able to defend that first takedown, forces into a boxing match, really. And the thing I liked about Francis too, he throws kicks now and they actually look decent. He doesn't just throw them out wild. Yes, the kicks are a little stiff. It's not like he's the most fluid guy in the world, but it's just another wrinkle that he is adding to his game. That's the great thing about Francis. He's always getting better fight in and fight out. And really the question is, how much longer will Francis keep on improving for? Do you think he'll keep on getting better for 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, or is this the final product? Because if this guy keeps on improving, he's only what, 34, 35? For heavyweight, that's really, really young. So he has a few more years ahead of him to keep improving, I believe, at least, until we do kind of see what that peak Francis looks like. So I think he is getting ready for a very long title reign.
Let's move it over to Stipe for a couple of different reasons. Number one, you know, Stipe typically has been the guy that's always been able to pull it out in the end, right? And every time that we thought you know, in the Cormier fights where he kind of made the adjustments he needed to make. And he's always, you know, Verdum was chasing him down. He, the thing he tried to pull on Francis last night actually worked on Verdum. You know, he plants his foot, turns and cracked him. And he put a good one on Ngannou, but I think he just didn't have, you know, he'd already been cracked a couple times. He didn't have it in him to drop Francis. So for Stipe, you know, everybody's talking about John Jones today. Where this really gets interesting, and we'll move on to what you think about the John Jones Ngannou matchup, and if you think that should be next. But what gets interesting is Jones really seems to be focused on the number that they're going to slide across the table for him to take this fight, and that may open the door for a rematch, a trilogy fight with Stipe, only because of the negotiating leverage that Stipe would have, oddly having lost but already having a win. Do you think that another fight, first of all, I'll ask you a three-part question, which is always a blast. One, do you think Stipe's earned an immediate rematch? It seems like a no-brainer, but do you think he's earned an immediate rematch? Do you think he wants an immediate rematch? And do you think that's the way the UFC is going to go?
I can answer the first and the third pretty easy. I do think he deserved an immediate rematch. He's the greatest heavyweight of all time, one of the greatest fighters of all time. Will it be next? No, it's not going to be next. They'll definitely either do Derek Lewis versus Francis 2 next, just because the good thing about Francis is when he was on his way up, kind of his second run to the title, if you will, he wanted to be a lot more active than he was. He was begging the UFC for fights. So hopefully that does make for him to be a really active champ. We'll be able to see him three, maybe even four times a year, because Francis fights tend to get over really fast. So as long as he isn't taking a lot of damage, we might be able to see Francis really active, and we might get, you know, the Lewis fight. We might get a Volkov fight. We might get the Jones fight, all within only like a year and a half. So hopefully Francis can stay active and we are kind of able to see all these great matchups. But one, I do think he deserves it. Three, no, they're not going to make it. And the Jones fight's interesting because I don't really know what John Jones does from here. And, you know, there's not many. I used to be a big John Jones fan. Let me get that out of the way right now. But times have changed and John Jones has changed. Bones Jones is not the same guy I grew up being a fan of. And I just don't think he can beat Francis. I really don't. You look at his boxing ability compared to what Stipe's is, and Jones leaves his head pretty wide open. Now, I'm not saying John Jones can't go out there, double leg Francis, take him down, submit him, ground and pound him. He could do all that. But the version of Francis that we saw last night, I just don't really know out there who can beat him. And I definitely know I wouldn't want to fight him. So if I'm John Jones, I'm asking for as much money as possible. And I'm asking for a warm-up fight too. That's what I want. I think what you had kind of said with Stipe first about how he should have taken John Jones, I guess this before we're recording, how he should have taken Jones and you want him to be the first fight at heavyweight. Francis is so happy right now. You're fighting a guy who's looked terrible in his last couple of fights against blown up 185ers for the most part. Now he's fighting one of the biggest heavyweights there is in his first UFC heavyweight fight. It does not go better for Francis if you're in the camp of Francis. So I'm welcoming that John Jones fight easily. If I'm Francis, I'm begging Dana White to give me that John Jones fight. I don't even ask for a raise yet, because just beating John Jones is going to make you such a big star in the UFC long term that even if you don't get paid that much up front for the Jones fight, if you are able to beat him, which I think Francis is able to, it's going to make you such a big star as a result. So, Stipe should get it. I don't think he will, though. And it is a shame, because for Stipe, I don't really know what else there is out there. He's beat most of the other top contenders. I threw Volkov's name out there just because maybe you could see him versus Stipe, but Stipe is in a really weird part of his career right now.
You know, here's where the Jones fight, and obviously you guys are going to break this down when it goes down, but the Jones fight gets interesting for me for this reason. I was talking to a friend of mine last night while we were watching the fights, and he said, I think John Jones is the same fighter at 250 pounds that he is at 220 pounds. And I said, well, I don't know if he's as fast. I just want to ask him specifically. I said, could you imagine a 250-pound John Jones doing a flying knee? Because I can't. And he said, yeah, I could. I disagree with him. But here's where I think it gets interesting. I don't know that John Jones could wrestle. I agree with you about the boxing. But I do think Jones's kicks become relevant in the fight. And here's the one question that I would have for you that would give me the biggest insight into whether or not John Jones can beat Francis Ngannou, and that is, do you think John Jones could hold Francis Ngannou against the cage? Because if he can, that opens up the Khabib Nurmagomedov-like takedowns, and it opens up that Muay Thai with the elbows. And if he could get Francis Ngannou against the cage, his elbows and his knees come into play. And I don't know that of all the things that Francis has figured out about the fight game. I don't know if he's got that one figured out yet. I think that's where Jones, and plus Jones has got the highest fight IQ. He's in the conversation, right? When you start opening, like, you know, if you were going to get together the five smartest fighters in the world and you had your choice of anybody, he's on that list, right? What do you think about what I just said?
I think you're right. And I think that's Jones. Really, that's his only path to victory. He's going to have to clinch. He's going to have to grapple in some aspect. And for Francis, it's interesting. And I'll make reference to the co-main event that we had last night. Vicente Luque is a much worse wrestler than Tyron Woodley is. The defense is easier to learn than the offense. And I do think with the improvements that we've seen from Francis Ngannou, fight in and fight out, he would be able to make that adjustment and get his back off the cage. And you hate to say if he just brute strength it, but you can get out of a few positions just by using brute strength. You don't always need to use perfect technique. I mean, Derek Lewis has made a career just getting up to his feet by being big and strong. So Francis might be able to just brute force his way out of some of those positions. But I do agree with you. If Jones can get him up against the cage, he is going to come over the top with the elbows. He is going to try to trip him, use the cage to his advantage. And those are things that really seasoned champs who are in there for a lot of 25-minute fights will pick up on as they start to progress throughout their career. But the thing is, for Francis, until you see it, you don't really know to train it. Because for him, really, what position, if you're Francis, do you have to train? We have to train how to touch gloves at the start of the fight, and I'm going to start throwing haymakers at people, and they're going to fall down. So I do agree with you 100%. I think Jones would have to get into the cage, and that is kind of what the fight comes down to. Could Francis get his back off the cage? I think he could. I really do. But as that fight progresses, it really just depends on at what point does John Jones' cardio really start to overtake just the brute strength of Francis.
You know, here's where this fight gets interesting, because I think that John Jones, although he's fought guys his size before, Gustafson, Dominic Reyes, like, he's been in there with some tall guys. He's never fought – how do I say this? John Jones has always been the bully. And he always fights downhill because he's bigger than everybody, right? So he kicks. So with Francis, you have to make a choice. And the choice is, I'm either all the way in or I'm all the way out. I can't get into the pocket with this guy. So I have to close the distance or I have to be at distance. And if he's resigned to do that, I think he could have some success. But I think that the idea, he would have to fight an underdog's fight in the sense that he's like when Randy Couture fought Brock Lesnar, he put together a game plan that involves, you know, it didn't work, but he put together a game plan that involves closing the distance, dirty boxing, roughing him up. Like, I think that he would have to limit Ngannou's space and dirty box him and rough him up and, you know, do a lot of things he's not accustomed to. But again, that's a breakdown for another day. And Matt, we move on to the co-main event. Matt, the co-main event had such a furious pace and was so frantic, it's hard to believe it only lasted one round. Former champion Tyron Woodley, who has looked unimpressive in his most recent outings, came out guns blazing. The caveat to my criticism of Woodley's recent performances is that they have come at the very top of the division. We're talking about Gilbert Burns, talking about Colby Covington. On this night, he was keeping the top five gate as Vicente Luque was approaching it, and Luque kicked the gate open, strangling the former champ at the end of the first. Matt, I have 10 cents. My 2 cents is free for this fight, but I want to hear what you have to say first, and then we'll go from there.
I love Vicente Luque, and I've been a big fan of his for a long time. This is one of the few guys that I can say I feel like I'm the conductor of this Vicente Luque hype train. I was a fan back when he was 10-7. That's what you call a very salty record, but I believe, I knew, he's got phenomenal striking, a very developed submission game, and if he can just get the wrestling defense together, he's going to become a nightmare for most guys in the division. And yes, he's had a couple losses. He lost to Leon Edwards. He lost his UFC debut. He lost to Wonderboy Thompson as well. But you really only look at those last two losses. Well, losing to Leon Edwards, well, there's no shame in that whatsoever. He's, what, 2 or 3 in the division? Losing to Wonderboy, again, one of the better welterweights to ever win a title. So the fact that he's only lost to those two guys, I always liken Vicente Luque to Charles Oliveira, at least up until he beat Tony Ferguson. Because you look at Oliveira, he beat a bunch of guys who were unranked, but you look at the way he was able to beat them, and he's very impressive. He's either choking them all out or knocking them all out. For Luque, he never had the chance to fight a guy in the top 15 because he is one of those names where if you get offered the boat sheet to fight Vicente Luque, why would I do that? He has five fans. I guess Matt Allen's 20% of his fan base, but he has five fans. He's a dangerous fighter. He's good everywhere. So why would I accept that fight? And for poor Tyron Woodley coming off three straight losses, not really in the position to turn a fight down. That's why I was really confident with my pick on Luque, and I actually put a bet down for Luque inside the distance, because Luque has beaten all of his UFC wins in all of his wins in the UFC have come by stoppage except for one. And the one that didn't was that gross broken nose that Mike Perry had when he got eaten, that big flying knee. So that means that fight would have got finished if it had gone on for, what, 30 seconds more, 40 seconds more. There's no way the doctor lets that fight continue. So Luque can finish the fight really anywheres, and that's what's so great about him. And he's a fun fighter too, and that's what the UFC likes to promote. He can speak English really well. He's a super exciting fighter. He comes from a really good gym. And again, the cool thing about Luque, you always knew how good the striking was. Now he is showing how good he is on the mat. And to go out there and submit Tyron Woodley, not just to submit him, be the only guy to ever submit Tyron Woodley, just a really impressive performance by Vicente Luque. And I'm glad that more people are going to start following him because of it, because go all the way back to UFC 205, headlined by Conor McGregor, Eddie Alvarez, the co-main event on that show, Tyron Woodley, Wonderboy Thompson. One of the first fights that night, I believe it was the first fight at MSG, was Vicente Luque, Bilal Muhammad. And who would have thought all those years ago that Vicente Luque would then go on to not only beat Tyron Woodley, but to basically knock him out and choke him out. Just crazy to watch the progression of Luque and to see how elite he has become. And for Woodley, he picked a terrible fight to be aggressive in. Like, you're fighting a really, really good counter striker who has fast hands, known for his power. I get you had him hurt, but when you're Tyron Woodley, you're the champ. You rely on your experience. You have high fight IQ, and it's almost a detriment because he has such high fight IQ. If you have your guy hurt, wouldn't you think Tyron Woodley would be, okay, I've got him hurt. I haven't had anyone hurt in a while. Let's stay reserved. Let's really make sure we get him out of there. Let's not just bum rush him and get knocked out ourselves. So for Woodley, I get it. He went out on his shield. People love to throw that out there. He's a warrior. Oh, he's so tough. He was the UFC champion. I think we all knew he was a warrior going into that fight. I'm glad they get the bonus. And here's the other thing. Craig was oddly upset that a one-round fight got a bonus. He doesn't believe a fight of the night can be a one-round fight. So if you disagree with that, and I really hope you do, please flood his mentions on Twitter. But yeah, just a really good fight. Great showing by Vicente Luque. And I don't really know what Tyron Woodley does from here on out. I know Chael Sonnen said again on ESPN that he got from a very good source that Tyron Woodley's name has been thrown out to fight Oscar De La Hoya in his boxing return. So maybe we do some weird cross promotion this summer. Who really knows? But just one of the sadder last parts of a UFC career for Tyron Woodley. He was, yes, people called him boring, but he was one of the better welterweights of all time. He was going and really rising up that goat mountain, if you will, to get up to where GSP was. And maybe you never thought he was as good as GSP, but he was starting to get the title defenses. He was looking really good. He is really well-rounded. And now for him to get dominated, really 15 straight rounds, like, he hasn't even won a round in, well, since he was champ. So just a really tough downturn for old Tyron Woodley in this stage of his career.
Yeah, I think if that was a rumor, that rumor's gone. Because if I'm Oscar De La Hoya, I'm not fighting a guy that just lost to Vicente Luque. Even if the world doesn't really know who Vicente Luque is, I mean, he's lost, you know, whatever it is, three of his last four. The thing for me that's interesting about Woodley is that he's in this weird conundrum. And again, watched the fights with a friend last night, and we discussed, like, if you fight a certain way and that style took you all the way to the title, and now you can no longer do it at the high level, the question becomes, do you change what made you great, or do you stick to it hoping that you'll find success again? Because you're fighting against the grain if you change it. And, you know, he's reaching that point in his career where he can be the matador. I mean, I'm sorry, he can be the bull, but no longer the matador. He can go in there and throw hands and still, you know, has the output. But when it starts coming back, he can't keep his head safe. He can't keep his chin protected, and he can't get out of the way of punches anymore. And I think that, you know, I just can't figure out. We're reaching the point with Tyron Woodley where we have to ask ourselves, how much do you value your legacy? And is it time? You know, there's no shame in losing to Gilbert Burns and Colby Covington. And I'm not really saying there's a shame in losing to Vicente Luque, because one compliment I'll pay Luque is that if you look at his resume, he does one of those things where when you're looking at a guy's resume and you're trying to figure out, do they have a chance to be somebody special? One of the things I always look for is, do they beat who they are supposed to beat? And if you look at Luque's record, he beats who he's supposed to beat, right? Like, he lost to Leon Edwards, he lost to Stephen Thompson, but everybody else is like, he beats Nico Price and he beats Randy Brown and he beats Bilal Muhammad. So he beats like who he's supposed to beat. It's just, can he make the next, you know, you and I talk about this all the time, the championship checklist. And I'm not trying to put this kid up for championships yet, but he is creeping up into that, near that top five. So we got to start. If he was a in any other division than 170, if he was a here's what I mean. If to say that Vicente Luque is ready for a championship run seems almost like blasphemous to say. But if you say guys that have less experience and have accomplished less in divisions with less depth, like if this guy was a 125-pound fighter, we'd be happy to say he's ready for a championship run. If he was a 145-pound fighter, we'd be happy to say, oh, give him Volkanovski or give him a Figueiredo. But it seems like because, you know, you have Usman and Covington and Edwards and all these guys, it's like, oh, okay, he's just Luque, let's slow down. This guy might be putting something together here, Matt. I mean, he might really be somebody that we have to take seriously. You know, I mean, I don't want to call him like a, you know, he's got some Shogun vibes with the quietness, and he's content to throw the hands. I don't want to quite, you know, lay that kind of pressure on him yet. But, I mean, am I underestimating what this kid could be? And I know I'm talking to the vice president or the treasurer of his fan club here. I mean, am I underestimating him a little bit by saying that he's not ready for prime time?
This is my theory, and it's going to be the little brother theory, and it's been thrown around a lot. Like, John Jones, he's a younger brother, and you look at who his older brothers are. It's Chandler Jones, and I think he plays football, and I'm pretty sure he's good at it. My football knowledge is very limited, though. But when you have an older brother who can beat up on you, you've got that chip on your shoulder, and I'm going to kind of flip that around. Gilbert Burns and Vicente Luque aren't brothers, but when Gilbert Burns is being brought up at 170, it was, he's the guy who's going to beat Usman. They train together. He's the guy who knows his game, and he could beat Usman. Vicente Luque also trained with Usman. And while all those eyes were on Gilbert Burns, that he's going to be the guy to beat Usman, and he could be the guy, he has such a unique style, he's going to offer all these different threats. What if that whole time Luque was like, yeah, but like, what about me, guys? And he sees his best friend getting all this shine, and he's getting better, and he's the one who everyone cares about. He's the one who's going to be champ one day. Vicente Luque is way better at striking than Gilbert Burns. It's not even close. And he does have a really good ground game, and I do think he has some of the skills that you look for when you do think of future champions. My only issue is that the champion in his weight class is my leading candidate of, when I look at the UFC, who could join the GOAT conversation. Like, Kamaru Usman's one of the few guys right now who I look at and I'm like, okay, he could go down as one of the greatest fighters of all time. Just, you look at his skill set and just how he doesn't really have any big holes whatsoever. I think of Luque, like you would said, if he was at 205 right now, people are asking for him to fight Jan Blachowicz. Like, that's the level of excitement he can bring to the cage. But I do agree with you. It's more because of his division, and that's why people aren't that excited. But I do think the fact that everyone was talking about Gilbert Burns, Gilbert Burns, and Gilbert Burns, well, I'm sure Vicente Luque's beaten Usman in the training room. I'm sure he's beaten Burns in the training room. He's right there with those guys, and I guess really no one knows better than him. So if he does think he's ready for these upper echelon guys, the elite of the division, then I trust his opinion because he's been in the training room with those other elite guys in his own weight class.
Here's where it gets interesting, and we'll move on. But like, for me, there's always these guys in the division that you think are really great fighters, but they just don't seem like they'd ever be champions, right? Like Benil Dariush we talk about, or Neil Magny we talk about, or, you know, Luque, or these guys that are just kind of like a Sun Tzu that win a lot of fights. And then next thing you know, they get near there, but they're not quite there. You know, John Fitch would be an example of somebody who just gets there. Damian Maia, these guys who beat a lot of people but don't ever win the really, really big fight. And then you see a guy like Jan Blachowicz, who is that kind of guy, and then goes out and gets the belt. And you think it gives you a little bit of hope that a guy that you wouldn't expect – you know, a guy like Kamaru Usman has champion written all over him from Jump Street. You know, he wins tough and he all these things, right? I want to see a couple more of these guys kind of break through and get to that next level. And Luque would be an interesting guy to see. All right, we move on. Matt, the Sugar Show is back at it on Saturday night. And this kid is all over the place, personally and professionally. Sometimes the Sugar Show is a Broadway show. Sometimes it's a freak show. On this night, he looked like he was ready for prime time. I'll say before we get into the result, that this was tremendous booking on the part of the UFC. A kid who's probably washed in Thomas Almeida, but once upon a time was on a hype train of his own. The result reads, Sean O'Malley defeated Thomas Almeida via KO, 352 of round three. It could have been over in the first. And Almeida was really never close. He was really never in it. Listen, O'Malley looks sharp, and you can give the full analysis. But let me ask the relevant question here, which is, would this version of Sean O'Malley have beaten Chito Vera?
That's a really good question. So I guess I'll start with the Almeida half of it. And it's that was the most boxing MMA fight you're probably ever going to see. And I tried to tell Craig this, and he didn't believe me, and he didn't believe me. And Craig's trying to get more into boxing, which is great. But he doesn't see that the UFC is still sometimes very similar to boxing, where when they have a star, they want that star to win. They do have preferential matchmaking so that when, you know, Sean O'Malley coming off a loss, we like this guy, his star qualities, we don't want him to really fall off. They're going to give him a guy in Thomas Almeida who's a very fun fighter. So worst case scenario, it could be a fight of the night. It's very clippable on social media. And then best case scenario, while Almeida has no chin and this guy's really good at knocking people out, I'm sure you can figure it out. So the UFC knew what was going to happen last night. They knew Thomas Almeida. Yes, he's a good striker, but he does leave holes to get hit, and he can't take shots, and that's the big problem. So for me, I don't think we learned that much about Sean O'Malley, honestly. Like, I think we know the same amount of Sean O'Malley before that fight as we do after. I just know he can beat Thomas Almeida, who does get knocked out a lot. Now, did he look good? Yeah, Sean O'Malley looked really, really good. I just don't know how good Almeida is at this stage of his career anymore. And for the Chito Vera half, I think Chito Vera is one of the better fighters in the division. He's not elite, but he's not just a prospect on his way up. Like, he has an upper tier UFC bantamweight. Their bantamweight division is arguably the best division in the whole sport right now. So that does mean something. I do think the grappling of Vera would give O'Malley problems. I think a lot that Vera does would give O'Malley problems. I'm going to say no, that version doesn't beat Vera. But here's the thing. I think the time that he's had since that fight would help him beat Vera if there was a rematch in the future. So I guess if that answers it, I'll kind of go with that twisted way of answering. But I think O'Malley looked good. I really did. I thought people just love to hate on him, and that's the problem, and it sucks. He's a young guy. I get it. He kind of brings some of it onto himself, but he does get better when you see him fight. And for better or for worse, it is good when guys do talk because it makes other people care about the sport that really not a lot of people outside of MMA really care about MMA all that much. So I think O'Malley looked good. Hopefully he can build upon this. I know Dominic Cruz said, oh, I'd fight him, so maybe that could be a fun fight in the future. I just don't know what you do with O'Malley if you can give him top 15 guys yet, or if you do need to build him up a little bit, because I'm a firm believer of build this guy up. There's no rush. There's no sense getting him in the top 15 just so he can lose like three in a row and then that's it for him. So I just don't really think you can give him that many more unranked guys because he will probably finish a lot of them. So he isn't a weird part of his career matchmaking wise, but I think he looked good all things considered.
Yeah, I'm kind of not sure how I feel about that Cruz fight, but I will say this. He did look good, and whatever ground he lost in the Vera fight, you know, he's now reached a point where he looked impressive enough in this fight that he can chalk all of that up to the injury. I don't agree with that, but it's the narrative he was already painting, so he could just continue to paint it because he'd look good in the return fight. I mean, you know, there's a part of the public that's going to believe that the fight was over in the first. If I'm him, I lean into that as well. I say, listen, I could finish him the first. That was on me. I thought I had him. I wanted the walk off. I almost do like a humble brag where I say, yeah, man, I messed up there. I had him done and whatever. So I guess what the interesting thing here is how much does he want to grow as a fighter? And the Cruz fight allows him to have someone who is going to give him a lot of looks he's maybe never seen before, who's going to have a high pace just like him. I think that if you continue to put him in there, the Thomas Almeida that used to run through this, that was really a high-level prospect that people were like thinking was going to be like the guy that was led to the resurgence of Shoot the Box, that guy would have been a hell of a fight for Sean O'Malley. That's not the guy that we have anymore. So I guess we got to figure out, you know, do we keep playing this game? Because you could do the thing with Dominic Cruz that you just did with Thomas Almeida, just on a higher level. You put O'Malley in there with a guy who we believe to be more, whose name is larger than his game in Cruz, and maybe O'Malley looks better than he would have, you know, he wouldn't look that this version of O'Malley wouldn't look great against Dominick Cruz of 5 years ago, but that's not Dominick Cruz that we have. So I'm with you in that I'm a little unsure, but I think that if this kid really wants to start going places, he needs to stop being a fucking meme and fight some guys that are going to expand his, you know, vision as a fighter and expand his skill set and make him have to have a deeper tool bag. And, you know, you could also make the case for running the Chito Vera fight back. So I don't know. I just know that I'm not quite convinced yet if he's going to sabotage himself outside of the cage, because he's just a different guy inside the cage than he is outside the cage.
And it's like when people bring up Zion Williamson, though, and I'm like, hey, he's really good, right? And the first thing everyone says is, yeah, but just wait until he gets hurt. Like, why worry about that? Just enjoy it while it's here. Like, Sean O'Malley, yeah, he's a fun striker. I wish that people could kind of separate the out-of-cage stuff from the in-of-cage stuff, because the thing about O'Malley, and I sound like his biggest apologist in the world right now, but I'm really not. It's just, it's not like Sean O'Malley's done anything that bad yet. Like, people do seem to act like he's doing John Jones type of things outside the cage. He hasn't reached that level yet. Like, he's not maybe making the best decisions, but it's not like he's wrapping his car around telephone poles and doing a bunch of drugs with a bunch of people. Like, it's not trending in the best direction, but I don't think he's done anything outrageous yet.
You're right. The mistake that Sean O'Malley has made so far is that he feels like he always has to provide a quote or say something crazy. So basically, he's Mike Perry without Mike Perry's criminal record. Meaning, like, Mike Perry's done some not cool things. He also says a bunch of clunky shit that can get interpreted in a bunch of different ways. Obviously, he's far more offensive than Sean O'Malley is. So you're right. If you were to compare what O'Malley has said to some of the things Mike Perry said, yeah, O'Malley's not that bad. It's just you start to piece together these things and you wonder, all right, what is this going to lead to? You know, I made a point with Craig on Early Stoppage, and I want to get your thoughts on it, because Sean O'Malley is in this sort of lane as well. I was very critical of Kevin Holland, and I posed the question and start the conversation of if Travis Luter is the right guy for Kevin Holland. And the reason why I said that was because, you know, the example I used, or analogy I used, was being a father and being a teacher, of which I'm both. And I said that you're most successful as a father and a teacher when you have a little bit of cut the shit in your personality. Like, when I walk into a classroom or when I walk into my house and kids are acting up, I don't say cut the shit, but I imply it, right? I'm like, all right, enough's enough. And my question was, if Travis Luter can tell Kevin Holland to cut the shit in the corner, if he can be like, hey, yes, you're talking a lot of shit, you promoted this fight fantastically, but now we're in the fight and you're pissing it away because you're in there chatting with your opponent and you're not really being a very effective fighter right now. And the thing that I said to Craig was, the best shit talkers are very disciplined in the cage, even though they talk a lot of shit outside the cage. The examples I gave were Chael Sonnen, Conor McGregor, and Colby Covington. So my question is, do you think O'Malley falls into that as well, where he is completely reckless in the promotion of a fight and outside of the fight, but when it comes time to fight, he is sort of disciplined? I mean, he does get a little sloppy at times, but he seems pretty locked in, no?
No, I do agree with you. And with the Kevin Holland point, I think it's a very good one. And I liken it to, remember when, I think his name was Andre, not Blatch, but David Blatt. That's who it was. He was the coach for the Cleveland Cavaliers and they had the best record in the NBA and they still fired him like 30 games into the season. They were just like, yeah, LeBron and him don't get along. You can be really good and everything can be going the right way, but if your players and your fighters don't respect you, then it's probably not a good fit. So I do agree with that Luter pick, and maybe not respect you is a little too harsh, but when your fighter is just so blatantly not paying attention to what you're saying and trying to get distracted, for lack of a better way of saying it, then no, I do agree with you. I do think if Kevin Holland had a guy like a Mike Brown or Javier Mendez telling him what to do, he might actually listen to them a little bit better and not try to do all those sort of gimmicks with yelling at the crowd or Khabib or whoever. So I do think that there is a good point there. But with O'Malley, I do think he falls under more of the Chael Sonnen category where, yeah, he's going to act up. Yeah, he's going to say some dumb things. But in the cage, for the most part, he is locked in. And I understand the walk-off KO, if you will, notwithstanding. But he still looked really good, and I do think he's just got such a fun skill set, because the thing about O'Malley is, I'm going to liken him to Adrian Yanez with this, because Yanez said it to Craig and I. Yeah, I'm a really good boxer, but like, I'm actually excited for when I fight a wrestler. I'm really excited to show what I can do off my back and all my grappling. The difference is that Sean O'Malley's actually really good at grappling, and he's sort of known for it almost. So I think O'Malley's skill set will carry him pretty far, no matter who his coach is. But I think that is an interesting point. And we're going to get a better answer for that when he does consistently fight guys in the top 15. If he goes in there and has a good performance against one guy, and then he just looks like a completely different fighter against a relatively even ranked opponent, then maybe we will say, okay, he is inconsistent. He's got to figure something out in his camp. But I do think it's a little too early to answer that question just yet.
It gets interesting because he's out of the lab and his main coach is Tim Welch, who's a friend of his. And I think that if he maybe had John Crouch as his head coach, and, you know, and Welch is the second, you might see a different guy. And maybe when he gets into the championship or, you know, world, the top 15s, top 10s, Crouch kind of moves over and assumes some of those responsibilities. We'll see. All right, real quick, I'm going to turn some lights on in here because the sun is setting on the West Coast headquarters of Fight Night Picks. So hang with us while I lighten things up. All right, Matt, we move on. Matt, the struggle in promoting women's MMA in the UFC is that they have two super dominant champions at both 125 and 135 pounds, and neither seems to have their title in any jeopardy at the hands of the top 10. At 125, Shevchenko has Andrade next. Lauren Murphy is sort of in the wings, and the youth movement is led by Alexa Grasso. But a little further down the line, we have a 25-year-old Jillian Robertson and 23-year-old Miranda Maverick. This fight was in a high-profile spot and a chance for the winner to gain some ground in the flyweight rankings. The matchup seemed close going in, but it was Maverick who separated herself in this one, Matt. I saw in Maverick, and maybe you could straighten me out here, I saw just kind of like a meat and potato striker who is big for the division. So I want your analysis. My really, really big question for you is, do you think that you would attribute more of this victory? And the victory is Miranda Maverick over Jillian Robertson, unanimous decision, couple 30-27s and a 29-28. Do you attribute more of this victory to Maverick being big for the division or her actual technique?
I'm going to attribute it more to her actual technique because Jillian Robertson is an awful striker. Not a hot take. I didn't just pull a Skip Bayless there. Like, when you look at her fights, it's really easy to figure out how you beat Jillian Robertson. You force her to become a striker. On the mat, she's very good, black belt under Dean Thomas, but when she is forced to strike, you do see these massive holes in her game. And for Maverick, I thought she did a really good job defensively on the mat against a really good grappler. So for nothing else, I do think her defensive grappling is really good. And yes, that's not the greatest thing to come at you with after a fight that, wow, they looked really good defending submissions. But it was true against someone like Robertson. When you get your back taken, it's not easy to get out of that position. And she was able to get back up to her feet in that second round, especially when she was getting out grappled, and do some good work on the feet. So I don't think you're giving enough respect to the actual skill set of Miranda Maverick. I think she's a decent striker, but Maverick has a bit of what I'm going to call the Macy Barber issue, where you're going to get to a certain point where you realize being big and aggressive, it only takes you so far. Like, Macy Barber is super big for the division, very aggressive, extremely heavy-handed, but that only does get you so far. I think Miranda Maverick is very similar to Macy Barber in that aspect, where I do agree with you. Her size is a factor, but I do think there is a decent fighter where Miranda Maverick is, and I do think that she's a fighter who can make big improvements in her game because she is only 23 years old. So right now, if you're already beating fighters like Jillian Robertson at the age of 23, then you're going to have a very bright future in the UFC. And John Anik, in their like post-year recap, if you will, for 2020, he had said that he believes Miranda Maverick might actually be the second best women's flyweight. And he said that at the end of last year after she'd only had one fight in the UFC. I'm not ready to say that just yet, but I thought she put on a good performance. I really did. And at her age in that division, which is still kind of settling and forming, I think she's going to be a player for a long time to come. I really do, because although, yes, her skill set is somewhat basic now, at 23, you're going to get better each and every time out there, and you're already almost a ranked contender in your division. So I do think she's going to be around in that top 10, top five atmosphere for a very long time.
Do you think that either of these girls have championship pedigree? Do you think that when they get their shot at the belt, do you think it'll be Valentina Shevchenko's belt, or do you think the division will have moved on, or Valentina will have moved on by then? I mean, they're so young, Like, when do you think that their time will come? Do you think it'll be, you know what I'm saying? Do you think that they'll progress to being championship level while she's still the champ?
Jillian Robertson could have a hammer and she wouldn't beat Valentina Shevchenko. Like, no matter what age she is, Valentina could be 90 and Jillian Robertson could be 25, like her age right now. I just think stylistically, Valentina and even Andrade, they're so much better than the rest of this division that it's really going to take a massive effort by any one of these contenders to finally get that title. So it's so hard to say too, because like you had said, Maverick is very green in her UFC career, and you look at how refined the skill set of a Valentina Shevchenko is, it really is hard to envision a path for Maverick to eventually get to that point. But I think when you do look at these sort of exciting contenders at 125, I think Maverick's at the top of the list. I really do. When you think about the Barbers, the Grassos, the Mavericks, even the Robertsons to a certain extent, I think Maverick's the best out of those four. I really do.
All right, let's move on to the first, last fight of us discussing the main card here, but the first card of the main card, which is Jamie Mullarkey defeating Kama Worthy by TKO, 46 seconds of round number one. What'd you have here?
I did not have Kama Worthy losing emphatically by first round knockout. I certainly didn't have that. That was just a wild performance. And for Mullarkey, you know how tough he is. I always go back and think of the Brad Riddell fight, which was his UFC debut. Isn't it cool how everyone at City Kickboxing, or really in Australia, is just like, oh, I beat you, let's just train together now? Because that really is the case. And it's cool to see Shane Young. He lost to Volkanovski, and now Volkanovski's one of his corner men. Brad Riddell, Jamie Mullarkey had a fight of the night in both guys' UFC debuts. Now Mullarkey's only three fights into his UFC career, and Brad Riddell's in his corner. So just a really cool wrinkle, I guess, to add that them boys stand there, get along after a fight, and you love to see it. But for Mullarkey, you know how good his wrestling was. You knew how tough he was. Now that his striking is showing improvements, I'm not ready to say he's going to be a top 15 guy by any means, but it was a good performance for him. And for Kama Worthy, he's a fighter who, I think, 7 of his 8 losses have come by TKO KO. When you get stopped that many times, you're going to have to look at yourself in the mirror and just kind of figure out what you're going to do next. You hate to see a guy get stopped that many times. And at 16-8, it's not the best record. You'd hate to see the UFC cut him, because I do think he can go in there and have an exciting fight with a lot of different guys. But I just don't really know where you go next for Kama Worthy. He's coming off 2 straight losses. So he beat Devontae Smith, who's a good prospect, but that was a weird fight. He beat Luis Pena, again, good come from behind victory. And then you lose to Otman Azaitar, who really likes potatoes and will be willing to smuggle them over balconies and through fences. And Jamie Mullarkey. So it's just been sort of a bit of a weird downturn for Kama Worthy. And I don't really know what you do next for either guy. I think Mullarkey was fighting for his UFC career, so good on him. He will be brought back. But for Worthy, it's tough. You're coming off 2 straight knockout losses. You've been stopped quite a few times in your career. I don't really know what you do next for Worthy. But like I said, great performance by Mullarkey.
Well, the weird thing is that, I mean, the guy's got one of the, depending on how you look at it, he's got either one of the best or worst nicknames of all time. He's the Death Star. It seems like there's a lot of Luke Skywalkers out there, because this dude's getting blown up every time, you know, every so often. I'm with you. I don't think that he is he's the kind of guy that probably should go to another promotion and see if he, you know, like, he's got enough of a name, and maybe it's just because we follow the sport, but he's got enough of a name that if he popped in PFL, that'd be fun. Or if he popped up, you know, here or there, it'd be interesting. But I think that as far as the UFC goes, it's probably time to move on. All right, let's move on to the prelims. Alonzo Menafield defeated Fabio Chiron by submission via Von Fluchoke. Round number one, 111 of it. What'd you have here?
I was screaming Vaughn Prue at Craig's house like I was Daniel Cormier after Rose Namajunas won the title from Joanna. Just Vaughn Prue, Vaughn Prue. It was awesome. And what a great way to win, too. I love seeing a Vaughn Fluke choke. I really do. Just such a fun submission. For Fabio Chiron, you can't miss weight in your UFC debut. There is not a better way to piss off Dana White than to miss weight in your UFC debut. He finally gave you that opportunity, and I get it. It was on short notice. I'm sure it's very hard to cut a lot of weight, but it's just a really bad look when you miss weight in your UFC debut and you get submitted by one of the most rare submissions in the UFC. So it was a good win for Alonzo Menafield, who really did need a win. He was one of those guys who, I felt like he beat a good fighter a little too early. He beat Paul Craig, and then it's okay. You have to fight Devin Clark, and then you have to fight Jimmy Crew, and then Ovince St. Preux, sorry. Those are hard fights for anybody. So to have a 2-fight losing streak against Devin Clark and OSP, there's really no shame in that, especially if you are a young guy. So I do think Alonzo Menafield's starting to improve in his UFC career, but beating Fabio Chiron on short notice doesn't prove a whole lot to me.
All right, Abubakar Nurmagomedov defeated Jared Gooden via unanimous decision. 30-27s all across the board. What'd you have here?
That fight was actually, that was the low-key most hilarious fight on the card, because Gooden went in there with such disdain for the striking of Nurmagomedov. And Craig and I had said, if your last name is Nurmagomedov, you're probably really good at wrestling. And of course, Abubakar is very, very good at wrestling, but it's not like he's some scrub on the feet. And Jared Gooden went out there and had his hands down by his knees, basically just looking to defend takedowns and throw hands. And he seemed really off put when Nurmagomedov started putting it on him on the feet. So good performance by Abubakar. He showed that, yeah, I'm not just a wrestler. I do have the striking. I've got the kicks. It was just a really impressive performance by him.
If you are a fan of the Fight Night Picks recap show, this is the moment you've been waiting for. I'm going to pronounce these two fighters, and all of you are waiting for me to butcher them. Not tonight. Not tonight, my friends. Mikhail Oleksiychuk defeated Modestus Bukauskas. No, I missed. Bukauskas. Modestus Bukauskas. He has split decision 29-28, 28-29, 29-28. Let's get into this, because I think that you have some thoughts on this, and I know that your brother has some thoughts on this. So let's chat about this fight. What'd you have in this one?
I don't really have thoughts on it. It's just Craig's been acting like he's never seen a close fight before, and it doesn't make very much sense to me. And here's the thing. That was one of the fights that we were split on earlier on in the week, and he brought up a lot of good points. I feel like I did too, where Oleksiychuk has the power advantage over Bukauskas. And I think we saw that in the fight. He was moving forward constantly. He was landing good shots. And yeah, Bukauskas is doing a decent job countering. But when you think back at who was landing the majority of the shots, it was Michael Oleksiychuk. And he really had him hurt to the body too at the end of the third round. So in my mind, it was first round for Lord Michael, third round for Lord Michael, second round for Bukauskas. So again, it was a close fight. It could have gone either way. I thought that was fight of the night, to be completely honest. I know we normally say that at the end of the show, who would you give the awards to? But if you're not going to give it to Luke A. Woodley, I would have liked to see Bukauskas and Oleksiychuk get it, because it was a great fight from the second it started to the second it ended. We had a great pace. We had great striking. Really nice performance by both guys. And it was a weird fight, because going into that, Bukauskas had lost both of his UFC fights. Well, he had lost the one fight before to Jimmy Crute, where he did not look very good. And for Michael Oleksiychuk, he had lost two in a row, so it was two guys coming in off losses, but you knew that they were better than the previous fights had shown. So hopefully this isn't it for Bukauskas, because I do think he's a very talented fighter moving forward. But yeah, it was a close fight. Personally, I thought Michael Oleksiychuk had won 2-1, but listen, it was a close fight. It could have gone either way. He's only been tweeting and like retweeting. It's this weird things that support the Bukauskas one. Listen, he could have won. Like if the judges at the end of that, if two judges had it for Bukauskas and one had it for Oleksiychuk, I would have been perfectly okay with that. It was a really close fight and it could have gone either way.
Listen, he's got some backup here, Matt. I mean, if I know your brother, there will be a picture of what I'm looking at right now on my phone, which is what he tweeted, which is all the MMA media members.
Oh, I know. But here's the problem. Every person who had tweeted that out had said, yeah, but it's a close fight. Could go either way. Like, I don't think anyone after watching that fight was really confident in the decision. And yeah, it is kind of funny that so many media members had picked that. But I don't think Craig understands that. Craig loves baseball, so analytics are his thing, and he really wants to be able to point to numbers that can really support, wow, this guy won. But unfortunately, we deal with the one sport where numbers don't really matter, and I understand Bukauskas might have had the edge in significant strikes, but not all significant strikes are considered equal. And for Oleksiychuk, when he landed, it was making an effect on Bukauskas. Bukauskas is the one, his face was puffed up. He was showing damage on his face. He had that big reaction when he got hit to the body. So I understand Craig was saying how a lot of those shots were hitting on the arms of Bukauskas. But at the end of the fight, just look at both guys. Bukauskas ate a lot more damage than Oleksiychuk did, and he was quite obviously hurt to the body. So again, if at the end of the night you thought Bukauskas won, I'm perfectly all right with that decision. But I did think Michael won 2-1. But again, really close fight, and I did think that was the fight of the night.
Question, full disclosure, did the outcome of this fight swing which of you had more wins in your picks?
Yes, it did.
So you're confirmation bias, very biased, right?
But here's the thing. Again, I can fully admit that Bukauskas could have won that fight. I thought he had rocked Michael in the first round. I thought he won the second round. So if you want to give him the first two, I'm perfectly all right with that. It's right. Just to
but
really
your
be upset
can't
about a close-quit decision.
Yeah.
to like, it's a split decision. It's a close fight. Again, right. I don't think anyone left that fight and after the third round. No one was that confident anyone had won. So he's really digging his heels in on this odd split decision on a prelim. And I'm not really sure why he's putting up such a fuss.
Listen, my side hobby, I have a job and then I do this on the side. My second side hobby is gassing up the Allen brothers to go at each other even more. So I enjoy this shit. So anyway, let's move on. the next one was, what do we got here? Omar Morales defeating Shane Young via unanimous decision. 30-27s all over the board. What do you have here?
I thought this fight was going to be fight of the night, and it certainly wasn't. Omar showed that he's a better wrestler than any of us thought he was. He had really nice clinch work, really good strikes, I guess, near the end of the fight, but it wasn't that great of a fight. Let's just call it what it is. Shane Young, an all-action fighter. Omar Morales, for the most part, puts on good fights, but Omar isn't fighting in the right weight class. I'm very adamant about that. He belongs at 155. I think he cut slightly too much weight, and it might not show in his performances as much, but I just think him cutting that extra 10 pounds does hurt his gas tank. And I think more than anything, it's a confidence. It hurts his confidence more than anything, because when he goes in there, it's not like he can really push this crazy pace. He does have to sort of time himself and really just withstand whatever he faces. So for Young, I really thought he'd be a lot more aggressive in this fight, but good win for Omar Morales. The weird thing for Omar is he beat Gabriel Benitez at 155 pounds. That's really impressive. I know I'm probably the biggest Benitez fan in the world, but he's a good fighter. You lose to Giga Chikadze at 145, not the end of the world. And then you beat Shane Young at 145. So I know you're worse than Giga Chikadze, but better than Shane Young. There's a lot of fighters in between there. So I do think we're going to need to see a little bit more of Omar before I get a good idea as to where his ceiling is. But listen, as an 11-1 fighter, he's very well-rounded. I will be interested to see who he's matched up with next.
All right, let's move on to Marc-Andre Barriault defeating Abu Azaitar via TKO. Round 3, 456 of it. What'd you have here?
Just a crazy fight. Abu Azaitar went out basically thinking, hey, fights only last 5 minutes, right? I don't need to pace myself. And he didn't pace himself whatsoever. He threw every single punch he could in that first round. Got as gassed as I've ever seen a professional fighter. And it was the weirdest finishing sequence in the world. He's tired. His mouth guard falls out. He goes to like bend over and pick it up. Then Marc-Andre Barriault hits him, drops him. Just a weird ending sequence, but really good win for Barriault, who has started his career 0-3. And then he has that one fight that he won against Oscar Peyota that got overturned due to a no contest. So it's his first UFC win, which really does mean something for him. It was a guy who probably was going to get cut if he wasn't victorious last night. But crazy to see, too, that Jaron Vallel, and I'm calling you out, Jaron. Jaron Vallel is the worst ref in MMA, and I think we do need to start talking about this. He gets so close to the fighters to where the fighters must think that they're always doing something wrong because he's breathing down their necks the second they get close to that cage. And so if Jaron Vallel had the footwork of like a Jason Herzog, where he's always on the tips of his toes, he can basically defensive slide like he's a prime Draymond Green, then yeah, I'd be okay with it. But he's breathing down these fighters' necks. He always seems to make one very drastic mistake in the fights. And I just think it's time to start talking about the fact that Jaron Vallel is not a very good MMA referee, and that's really my only point about that fight.
Really quick, do you think Draymond Green is the best defender of all time?
Here's the thing, and this might be a bit of a hot take. I think he's the best defender I've ever seen. Like, I don't know many guys who can really guard opponents 1-5 and really do a good job with any of them. So I think he's the best defender I've ever seen, if that counts for anything.
It does count for something. The only pushback that I would have to that is that Dennis Rodman could do all of those things, and Dennis Rodman defended bigs when bigs were bigs, and Draymond Green has it. Like, Dennis Rodman defended back-to-the-basket bigs, if that makes sense. And,
well, it's like my whole GOAT thing. Like, yes, Michael Jordan's the greatest of all time. I never saw Michael Jordan play. That's my only pushback. So, that's fair.
All right, let's move on to the wrap. Let's talk about the performances of the night. We got Stipe Miocic and Francis Ngannou fight. $50,000 went to Francis Ngannou. Fight of the night was Tyron Woodley and Vicente Luque. I meant to say this earlier. My pushback to Craig saying a one-round fight can't be fight of the night would be that'd be the same thing as saying that no one-round fight is better than any three-round fight, which is insane. It's an insane statement to make. Just because a fight goes three rounds doesn't mean it will qualify. And lastly,
Flood his mentions, folks. Tell Craig what we're telling you.
And then Almeida and O'Malley, performance of the night, $50,000 goes to Sean O'Malley. Let's talk Victor. Well, first off, are you content with all those performances tonight?
Yeah, I'm good with all those. Again, if you wanted to maybe take O'Malley's, give it to Malarkey, because he did get a knockout in, what, under a minute? That's pretty impressive. If you wanted to give it to Alonzo Menafield, too, for getting that Von Flew choke, I'd be perfectly all right with that. And the only other one, I had mentioned it before, Michael Olczajczyk, Modesta Pukauskas, that was a fight of the night contender. If you want to give it to Woodley Luque, I'm perfectly all right with that. But if you were just looking for parity and wanted another one, then yeah, the Olczajczyk Pukauskas fight was really good.
All right, let's go on to the victory lap. Let's talk about where you were right, and then we'll get on to where you were wrong. What did you completely nail last night?
So the only fights I got wrong was the Zaitar. I thought he was going to win, and I thought Cam Worthy was going to win. So I had a pretty good card overall. I called Luque finishing Tyron Woodley. I just don't think the narrative of, oh, but he can land that one shot. Yeah, he doesn't throw the one shot, and that's a big problem. Like, at what point do we realize that these guys are the same people that they were when we were fans of them? And for Tyron Woodley, he's just not that guy anymore. He's not the same chosen one. That's Tyron Woodley. That's not the chosen one. So I was able to predict Luque to finish Woodley. I thought Francis is going to win. I didn't think he'd look as good as he did, but overall, I can take a bit of a victory lap. I had a good night betting. I had a good night prediction-wise. It was just a great night of fights overall.
All right. We didn't do this as we went along. So because I'm, you know, quick on my feet, let's do it at the end here. What coaches do you think are calling tomorrow? Who do you think the matchmakers are calling? And who do you think Dana's calling? Let's start with the coaches. What coaches are like, first thing this morning, they were on the phone with their fighters?
I hope these coaches were with them just because they were like, hey, what are we going to do next? Because for Woodley, it's not up to me. It's not up to you. It's not up to the UFC. It's up to his friends, his family, and his coaches to decide if he wants to keep on fighting. Because I'm at the point now where I'm cool if Tyron Woodley doesn't fight anymore. And I understand, yes, I would lose fights to Colby Covington, Kamaru Usman, Gilbert Burns, and Vicente Luque too. But the fact that he was a champ and he's not even being competitive in a lot of these fights is a little upsetting. So I think his coaches should probably be giving him a call. And for Sean O'Malley, I'm going to say the same thing. I don't think the UFC should be giving Sean O'Malley a call being like, hey, let's get back into business. Let's start hyping you up again. I need to see you do what you did last night one more time, and then I'm ready to get back on the train. Prove to me that you can actually fight a heavy-handed striker and not just what I'd more like into a pretty striker in Thomas Almeida, because it's not like he's the most hard or heavy-handed guy. When you really look at Almeida's record, and listen, I was guilty of it. I thought he was going to be UFC champ. I can fully admit that before he fought Garbrandt. He never beat a good guy in the UFC. Like, Thomas Almeida's UFC record isn't that impressive. He really only beat, his best win was Anthony Burchak, probably. Maybe Brad Pickett, who was really a 125er, who had moved up. If you want to look at who Thomas Almeida's UFC wins are, Tim Gorman, Yves Yaboyne, Brad Pickett, Anthony Burchak, Albert Morales. Really? That's the guy who I thought was going to be champ. So more than anything, I'm just an idiot. But Sean O'Malley's coaches, I do think they need to go back, talk to him, figure out why did you think you had him out in that first round, I guess. What are we going to work on? What other little improvements can we make in that fight? So the last point too, if I'm Dana White, I'm not calling anyone on this card. I'm calling John Jones. I'm doing everything I can to make sure that fight can get set up between him and Francis. Because for Francis, he's going to take the fight no matter what. I don't think Francis is like a really hard negotiator, and I don't think he's looking to make like $20-30 million to fight John Jones. I just think Francis wants the chance to prove that he is the best fighter in the world and that he can beat John Jones. Whereas John, and I agree with him, if I'm John Jones, I'm trying to make as much money as possible, and I would be doing exactly what he wants to. But for John Jones, you don't have to fight Francis Ngannou. You can do other things. You can take a warm-up fight at heavyweight. You can go down and fight Jan Blachowicz. There's options for you. So if I'm Dana White, I say screw it. Last night was great. Everything's fine and dandy, but I'm making sure I get that Francis Ngannou-John Jones fight booked for as soon as possible.
I'm with you. I think my only pushback would be that I think, you know, if I'm the matchmakers, I'm probably getting on O'Malley and Maverick's pages and just seeing kind of where they're at. I think, who did Vicente Luque call? Did he call it Nate Diaz?
He called it Nate Diaz. Here's the thing.
How do you feel about that?
Luque, I think he kills Nate Diaz. I really do. Because you look at, what does Vicente Luque do really well? A, he's got one of the best chins in UFC history. He's got really good cardio. He hits five times harder than Nate Diaz. And here's the other thing. He throws wicked leg kicks. We didn't see any against Woodley, but the majority of the time, Vicente Luque whips out these vicious leg kicks. So it's a terrible matchup for Nate Diaz. And that's why, unfortunately, he's never going to take the fight.
Yeah, and you know, Chael said something once upon a time that was, never make a call out that you can't deliver, because it makes you look like you have less power in the business. And this would be twice now he's called out Nate Diaz. He even said it in the interview, which made it look even worse, where he said, I called you out before and you ignored me. I mean, if you want to get some juice, man, you got to call out people that you can deliver on. So I want to move on a little bit to the notebook dump. We don't always get into this, but I have a couple for you tonight. The first one is when Teddy Atlas compared Sean O'Malley to Prince Nassim Hamed. I mean, this is a guy that's way out of your purview. But I guess my question for you is that he said that I haven't seen anybody who is as unorthodox of a performer as O'Malley since not Prince Nassim. Let's take Prince Nassim out of the equation. Do you think that O'Malley is that unique? I mean, I feel like I've seen dynamic guys before. I don't know that O'Malley's any more dynamic than Connor is or unorthodox than Connor is.
Yair Rodriguez. Like, what Yair can do is way, I don't want to say more technical than what Sean O'Malley does, but it's definitely harder to pull off, I would say. Even Uriah Hall would be another good example of a guy who can do those techniques. And yeah, for O'Malley, he is just really flashy with his techniques. Like, even his jab, the way he does slide in because he's got that wide stance, it looks really nice. So I understand why Atlas would say that. And he is somewhat newer to the sport. So for Yair not telling USADA where he's at, he probably hasn't had the chance to see Rodriguez fight. But there are some other guys out there who I do think are similar to O'Malley in the striking. Like, Israel Adesanya's boys with Teddy Atlas, I think he's much more dynamic than Sean O'Malley is. So I think O'Malley's unique, don't get me wrong, but I don't think he's a one-of-a-kind by any means.
I appreciate Teddy's involvement in the sport. I appreciate his recognition of great. But I'm with you. I mean, you can't be aware of Israel Adesanya in the way that he's aware of Israel Adesanya and then make it seem like Sean O'Malley is the, you know, the next coming of, like, you know, it's like you can't be aware of Dr. J and act like Michael Jordan's something, doing something you've never seen before. All right. My other big takeaway from this one is this whole Jacksonville business. So the UFC's coming back. They're going to Jacksonville. It's a pretty stacked card, and they're having fans again. Now, I will say, for my part, I've been to Jacksonville one time and one time only. I went to go see a Jaguars-Eagles game, and Jacksonville was one of the biggest shitholes I've ever been in with a bunch of jerk-offs. Now, that aside, what do you think about the UFC coming back? Do you think that they're I mean, we got to step very carefully when we're criticizing Dana, because he's been right throughout this whole process. Do you think it's sort of their problem to deal with, or do you think that, no, it's not time yet? What are your thoughts just on coming back?
I don't think it's the best time by any means. And it's hard to say that because I do understand where Dana White's coming from. And it is really easy to hate on what Dana White wants to do. Like, I thought he was coming back too early in the pandemic. And like you said, he was right as a result. And it, so far, at least, it has seemed like the UFC really has done everything they can to put on safe events. And I think a lot of time we do try to focus a little bit too much on the negative and less on the positive. But in this case, you're dealing with, what, 20,000 people shoulder to shoulder? It might not be the best idea. And if you can have proof that, yes, maybe people are vaccinated or whatever, you might be able to get away with it. Maybe the UFC pulls this off and everything goes well. But if you think of what the worst case scenario is, where one person coughs and 1,000 people get COVID, like, that's worst case scenario. And that's not really something that I would think that the UFC lawyers would want to get all held up in. And I saw that there was that, like, disclosure form that you had to sign if you bought tickets to where you were aware that you could die if you went to go the next UFC event. So I do think it's a little too early to be coming back, but I do understand why the UFC wants to. A lot of the revenue does come from the gate. It's the reason why we don't see a lot of stars fighting during the pandemic. Deontay Wilder's basically come out and said, like, yeah, I don't really want to fight until I can get a live gate. And there's a lot of guys out there like that. So I understand what the UFC is doing and why they want to do it this way, but I do think it is just a little bit too early for them to be doing full capacity, at least the way that they want to achieve it.
Yeah. And here's the other thing that I think is that I think that if you're the UFC, you are a leader in sports when it comes to this. You've established yourself as that. So here's where it gets weird for me. I am vaccinated. I'm only vaccinated by virtue of being a teacher, right? So I've gotten both my shots and I'm completely vaccinated. I continue to wear a mask everywhere I go because the people that see me in public don't know that I'm vaccinated. Like, meaning this, I go to my son's baseball game, I see a ton of people without masks on. I wear my mask when I get out of the car until when I get back in the car, because people don't know that I'm vaccinated. They just see me with my mask off and think everything's cool. So that's why I wear my mask. I'm like, I'm trying to send a message. With that being said, if you're the UFC, I don't know what's worse, if you pull this off or if you don't. Because if you pull it off, now everybody thinks, okay, we're in the clear. The UFC just did 20,000. It seems interesting to me that they were touting how fast the event sold out. Where that gets weird for me is, if you're saying the event sold out quickly, that's telling me that you didn't do anything. You didn't have anything in place that would take time. Meaning, there was no contingency of buying a ticket on having like a negative COVID test. Now, is that just something for show? Because obviously if you take a COVID test the day you buy the ticket and the event's 2 months later, what the hell good does a COVID test matter? If you were negative in March, you could be positive in May, who the hell knows? But I'm just saying that there was no protocols in place for that. It's just like, hey, here's the fine print. If you die, don't come crawling, you know, don't have your family come knocking on our doors. So I'm with you, but yeah, I mean, I a little bit feel like I have to defer to Dana because I've been critical and he's been right so far. All right, lastly, UFC on ABC 2 is the next thing up. It is April 10th. We got a big fight, Matt. We got Darren Till and Marvin Vettori. Everything is pointing towards this is for a title shot. What do you think about the fight? Do you think the winner deserves a title shot no matter what? Or do you think with an impressive victory, one deserves a title shot?
If the winner's Italian and named Marvin Vettori, then yeah, he deserves a title shot. And if the winner isn't Italian and named Marvin Vettori, then no, Darren Till doesn't deserve a title shot. Robert Whittaker just beat him and then beat Jared Cannonier. And then in another week's time after Vettori fights Darren Till, we'll be fighting Kelvin Gastelum. And if he's able to get past him, how can you say Darren Till is more like or more deserving of a title shot than Robert Whittaker? So I do agree with you. Though, where if Vettori wins, and if he can win impressively, the storyline's kind of there for him and Adesanya. Their first fight was close. It was a split decision. I thought Adesanya won 2 rounds to 1, but still, the judges were split. And with Whittaker, I love Robert Whittaker, one of my favorite fighters, but he did kind of get stopped twice against Adesanya. So less people will be clamoring to see that rematch, where when you look at Vettori, he did pose a very interesting stylistic matchup to Adesanya. So I think it is a really fun fight. And I think this is weird too, because Adesanya did the same thing going into this fight as he did going into the Cannonier or Whittaker fight. And I know we talked about this before, where he was like, okay, I want to fight Cannonier. Like, Cannonier haven't fought before. I think he could be the next guy in the division. And Cannonier loses. Well, now Adesanya's going, Darren Till, Darren Till, Darren Till. Well, if Marvin Vettori beats Darren Till, then I think Adesanya's kind of been overlooking probably what's going to be his hardest fight at 185 in Vettori. And I think if Vittori's able to beat Darren Till and rip a really good promo, it's very likely we see Marvin Vettori Israel Adesanya 2 in the near future.
You know, Conor McGregor never really did rematches until he had to. And I think that that's kind of like a little bit the playbook that Adesanya's reading from. And he's like, I'm such an interesting matchup stylistically for everybody that if they don't figure me out on the first try, I'm not giving them a second. And I think that's kind of why he's steering away from like Vettori, Whittaker. You know, in fairness to him, it might just be a simple case of, I already beat the guy, why should I fight him again? And, you know, Darren Till's a bigger star than Marvin Vettori is. I mean, he's going to bring a lot more eyes than Marvin Vettori will. But I'm with you. I think the Vettori certainly has earned that fight. Whittaker, obviously, with a win, will earn a rematch, but it'll be interesting to see how it plays out. All right, guys, there you have it. One more in the win column, one more for the highlight reel, one more for Fight Night Picks. Peace.